Hi everyone, Vicky here from Double Maker, introducing our bonus episode of the Double Maker podcast. This time, Tomas is our host, and a quick note about Double Maker, it's an annual maker festival funded by Science Foundation Ireland. Take it away, Tomas.
Hello, and welcome to the Double Maker podcast. I'm your host, Tomas Ward, one of the Double Maker team. Vicky, the usual host, is on holidays this week. So I will be on my own talking to Joe Timoney from Maynooth University today. Joe represents the Maynooth Makers Club, who are always in attendance at Dublin Maker, actually from the very first event in 2012. Joe always brings a musical twist to his makes and his builds. So I hope today we can learn a little bit about what inspires Joe in his making, and in particular, we might learn a little bit about electronic music making. So, Joe, welcome to the show.
Hi, Tomas. Good to meet you. And thanks for inviting me onto the show.
Yeah, cool. How are you getting on?
Well, it's been very busy over the last while with all the restrictions. And I haven't left the house that much. I miss the Maker Fair this year a lot. It's always a great experience in July to get outside and warm weather and meet people, talk about making, and have fun talking about the things I enjoy doing.
You always have a very noisy exhibit, Joe. I mean,
well, that's right.
we nearly always need to give you a tent on your own. And when we lay out the tents about who goes where, we're always going to be very careful about who we put near you. Because you turn it up to 11 a lot of the time.
Well, this is it. Well, we always like to make draw a lot of attention to ourselves and bring people over. But we have been very successful over the years in drawing crowds and entertaining them with our funny stories about why we're making music. Yes, there has been some incidents too when people we've shared the tent with have got completely frustrated by the end of the evening. But anyway, that's the fun of making, isn't it?
Joe, what I always notice about your exhibits that you have, you always seem to attract some very passionate, you know, attendees at Double Maker, and you know they are you're surrounded usually by a bunch of people who are really, pardon the term, but real anoraks about electronic synthesis and music production and music technology, and you get into some very deep conversations there.
Oh, you would do, yeah. Oh, I do, yeah. It's great fun. I think, I think a lot of people have come across electronic music in some form or another, whether they've realized that or not. I have a few examples here I play today of coming from, you know, movie soundtracks, where once electronic instruments appeared, they've been used particularly in sci-fi. Not just sci-fi, but particularly in sci-fi. And maybe they've also appeared in some favorite TV shows we've had, and also in horror music. And I suppose that was my first exposure to electronic instruments. But I didn't really know what they were, except they sounded different.
As a kid in the 70s, watching Star Trek with my dad on a Saturday, and the theme tune to Star Trek, that's got to be, was that a theremin or something, was it?
I'm not sure, but certainly as that instrument at the start has this ethereal spacey sound. that makes it, it kind of knows we're in a different dimension anyway. It's really to tell us that we're somewhere else.
Yeah, we're in a different dimension, all right.
I guess the one for me, really, the first one that really did it for me was from Close Encounters of the Third Kind. And that was, I saw that movie. I was actually brought to see that movie in the cinema, I think in 1978 or 79. It kind of came after Star Wars. And
very different to Star Wars, right?
It was, yeah. But I suppose they were kind of from the same stable, and that George Lucas and Steven Spielberg, they were friends with each other, because they came together to make Raiders of the Lost Ark, a few years later.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so
And in terms of music, would those directors have had, you know, much interest or, you know, well, much involved?
Yeah, well, I think the soundtrack composer for both Star Wars and Close Encounters was John Williams. The big difference maybe between Star Wars and Close Encounters was that there was, near the end of the movie, there's this meeting between the humans and the aliens. And when the alien spaceship is, you know, coming towards the mountain, there's an exchange using electronic instruments and the music of the spaceship. So maybe I'll play a little example.
Oh, yeah, that's a great idea. Wow, this is pretty wacky already. I love it. Oh, yeah.
So you can get an idea from that. So there's an exchange between this, you know, space age electronic instrument and I think it's a bassoon playing in quite a low register, and you know, that gives you the feeling of the future talking to the past.
It does, yeah. I never thought of it like that, but yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, well, I suppose, you know, John Williams was very much the a classical composer. He used an orchestra, but the introduction of these other instruments helped to give a feeling of the future. And that was very much, I think, a 70s thing. I have maybe another example I could find that I suppose came to me later on, but there was, and maybe you might remember this TV show when we were young, it's one called Logan's Run.
Oh, yeah. Logan's Run, absolutely classic.
Yeah, and Jerry Goldsmith, the composer there, he's actually quite famous for his introduction of electronic instruments into his music. And he also pioneered a lot of this. Now, I guess one of his most famous soundtracks is possibly Planet of the Apes, which is electronic instruments. But he certainly used a lot of special effects.
Are you about to put something on there, Joe?
Yeah, but give it a second.
Am I right in saying I'm kind of hearing you reaching out for a piece of vinyl? Are we talking vinyl here?
Yeah, it's vinyl.
Of course. Right. Let's hear it.
So you can hear in that kind of the mixture of this, you know, creepy synthesizer at the very beginning, and then it goes into the orchestral theme. But
what sort of technology were they using to produce those sort of sounds?
Well, they were using actually the synthesizer he used for that. I think Jerry. Who did Jerry? It's written somewhere in the internet who he borrowed that synthesizer from, or he was able to use it in a studio. That was probably one of those modular systems where. Mm-hmm. You connected all these modules together to make the overall instrument. So it'll be like you have an oscillator module, you have a filter module, you have an envelope module, you have some mixer module, and different effects modules that you would all combine together. And that was very much in the spirit of making an electronics when they started in the 60s. You know, people who made these instruments. In the beginning, they just made them in a DIY sense. And I suppose that has kind of carried through because the always behind the electronic instrument market as such, you have these consumer products, but also you have either small boutique companies making modules that you can kind of plug together to make your own instrument. Or you can actually buy them as DIY kits and make them from scratch yourself, you know. The internet has made things much easier in that way. And that really got me started into making because I was able to buy some kits and really start working on them. And at least when you have a kit, you have an idea that you won't make a terrible mistake, but you have the pleasure of trying to put it together and get it working.
And Joe, to reproduce some of those sounds that we're hearing there, some of that, you know, that vintage sound, is there any sort of starter project you would recommend for people to take a look at? Well, you know, something fun, something that, as you said, fairly forgiving, but gives you something very
Maybe one of the most famous brands is Paya, which is an American brand.
How do you spell that?
Yeah, well, we had that at the Makersphere, maybe in one of the first or second ones.
Paya?
Yeah, Paya Fatman. And it's a small two-oscillator analog synthesizer with a 12 dB per octave state variable filter, I think. And it has a simplified envelope. I don't think it is ADSR, but it may have attack, decay, and release or something like that. But
For people out there, what's ADSR?
It's the envelope. So that's the shape of the volume of the sound. So a short ADSR is like a very short sound, while a long ADSR would give you kind of more like a string, like a long string.
Oh, yeah, I get you.
Well, maybe I could give you a good example of what would be a short ADSR.
Yeah.
Now, this is actually another famous track, if I can.
Joe, when I'm listening to you, I'm hearing you either in your bedroom or in a sitting room surrounded by stacks of vinyl, and you're reaching around. Is that what you're doing?
I'm surrounded by stacks of vinyl. You have many, many records. Well, I got into buying records when I was young. There was a neighbor of ours, actually, who got me into it. And he was into buying soundtracks in the beginning, and he got me into soundtracks.
Into soundtracks. Oh, that's already you were niche from the get-go.
They were, I think soundtracks were very exciting back in the 70s and 80s. I don't know if you remember that tune.
Yeah, is that Jean-Michel Jarre?
Well, Jean-Michel Jarre was involved in producing the original. That's not Jean-Michel Jarre's version, but it is a version of the tune. So that's Popcorn, which was early 70s. They used to play it on the radio. But that's an example of a short ADSR. So if the ADSR is very, very short, you'll get this Popcorn
I get you, I get you. Wow,
that'd be an apt example of that.
Yeah, but you just brought me back there to Jean-Michel Jarre. That's right. He really popularized synth, didn't he?
Well, he was quite melodic, and I think I think many other artists said, well, you know, Jean-Michel Jarre brought the melodic sound of synthesizers to people. That there was other people doing similar work, but just maybe not as melodic as he did. Somebody said recently, Jean-Michel Jarre could have had an accordion band with the same tunes, and he would have been as popular as having used all the synthesizers. But he had a knack for melody, and I think Oxygen was a huge hit in the 70s. And I think that did inspire a lot of people to get interested in electronic music.
Yeah, he also made quite a spectacle out of electronic music, if I recall.
He did, yes, he certainly. And he was, you know, he got to play those concerts in China. So he was one of the first Western musicians to go to China.
But didn't he also have all sorts of interesting ways of interfacing with a synthesizer? I remember, did he not have a light organ or something?
He did, he had a laser harp.
The laser harp, that was it. I mean, I still remember that from seeing it back in the 80s.
Yeah, well, I think...
That's a nice.
Yeah, well, lasers became quite popular. I think lasers as a technology kind of came out in the late 60s into the 70s. And then they were used in light shows from
Yeah, they struggled to find an actual practical application. I remember that.
Hmm?
They struggled to find practical application initially.
In the beginning, yeah. Well, lasers are used everywhere now. But
yeah. They
were used a lot in light shows. And I think there were some pioneering artists that actually, you know, brought the laser to, to musical light shows. One example, actually, of that is Tim Blake. And on his album, Crystal Machine, Tim Blake played keyboards with Hawkwind, but he had a couple of solo records.
Many of our listeners, Joe, will be saying, who's Hawkwind?
Well, Lemmy was in Hawkwind.
This would be like the School of Rock when I had to bring people all the way back.
I guess in the early 70s, there was a lot of psychedelic bands that... A show was more than just a music performance. It was an experience. It was like bringing people into another dimension. And this is the start of Crystal Machine by Tim Blake. And there's a lovely picture of him with some synthesizers and a big laser light behind him, doing that kind of tunnel effect. Now, I think they were quite difficult to work with back in the 70s. And I think we're quite luckier now that if we tried to build our own laser harp, it'd be quite possible to do, and to do it more safely than when Jean-Michel Jarre did it.
Yeah, I could imagine, yeah.
That's Tim Blake.
Now, it's funny. Now, that reminds me of Brian Eno.
You could do, yeah.
That was about 1980s, wasn't it? Early 80s.
Well, Brian Eno would have changed by then, I think. Brian Eno would have... he was making a slightly different style. I guess Tim Blake was more kind of like the psychedelic... that's where his roots were, while Brian Eno was more in an ambient. I could give you an example of Brian Eno if I could find my David Bowie album here. Of course, David Bowie's famous Low record was one where he collaborated with Brian Eno to do synths. And I think that was another influential album on me, because I really liked David Bowie when I was... growing up. David Bowie's Low album is a great example of Brian Eno type synthesis. And
okay, you have it there, do you?
I do, yeah. I have it here now.
You're going to put it on the turntable? Wow.
Well, this is his famous track, Warsawa.
Mm-hmm.
It's a mixture of piano and synthesis.
Thank you.
that's, you can hear that's a lot more broody now.
And it is, yes. That's got a long ADSR. Is that right? Has that got a long ADSR?
It does, yeah. The long, long notes, long, dark notes, heavy bass. And I guess that's the other thing. Well, this was the great thing with synthesis, that you can make so many different sounds from the one instrument. And I guess anyone who's a maker, that's very attractive. You can make something that's so flexible. And, you know, not only can you create the instrument, but then you can create lots of things with that instrument.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's endlessly extendable.
Yeah, this is it. That makes it very exciting.
Experimental. And Joe, what was the, was there, I mean, growing up, I suppose, in Ireland in the 70s and 80s, right, you're inspired by this music, but I suppose getting access to any sort of opportunity to create your own with that sort of technology would have probably have been difficult, right?
Yeah, it was quite difficult. I guess things are much easier nowadays. But well, there were some shops in Dublin that did sell those type of instruments, but I would have been a little bit young to know much about it by the time. Let's say when I was in my 20s then. So the biggest shop in Dublin, I think, was Yamaha Danfei, which was up in Angel Street, which is...
That's right, I remember them. Yeah,
they're completely gone now. And I think they sold quite a lot of Yamaha instruments. Yamaha themselves did a lot of analog synthesizers in the 70s, but then crossed over into digital synthesizers in the 80s. And they really took control of the market for a while with the Yamaha DX7, which was hugely popular. And a lot of 80s music has a DX7 all over it.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah,
now, I might be able to find an example of that.
Yeah, I would not be surprised if you have a lot of 1980s DX7.
This 80s pop hit probably has a DX7 on it. But I picked up this other thing recently by a Japanese artist called Logic System. And the album is Venus. When I listened to it, I thought it sounded very DX7, but I could be wrong now. We'll see. That sounds DX7. Mixture of instruments in there, I think.
They sound great. That last one in particular.
Yeah, it's so that's kind of an interesting record. But I guess you know, Japan was very famous for those type of instruments in the 1980s, and that person actually he worked with Isao Tomita, who was very famous for doing versions of synthesis versions of classical music. I could do a quick... Oh, yeah, the Planets, maybe. His most famous one is the Planets. And I remember being with a friend of mine in Comet Records 30 years ago.
Wow, Comet Records, yeah. Another blast from the past there, yeah.
He picked it up, and it was actually... Tomita got in trouble with Holtz's family because they didn't like him, his desecrating Holtz music by turning it into a synthesis, using synthesizers on it. But it's since been recognized as kind of a classic.
Oh, I can't quite hear that.
Oh, I'll turn it up.
Oh, yeah, I hear it now.
So this is Holtz doing Mars. I think that's one of the more famous tunes from that. Well, really, Holtz is the father of the film soundtrack, really. Those are some suitably strange sounds in there. Will that not be an inspiration for any maker to wonder, well, how the hell did they do this?
That's pretty that? Wacky, Joe.
What?
That sounds pretty wacky. But what, you know, listening to that and thinking about that period and maybe access to electronic music reminded me that, sure, when I was a kid, I couldn't obviously produce any music with any kind of analog synthesis like that. But what I do remember is the 1980s being an era of, you know, when people began to see an influx of computers into people's homes, personal computers, like Sinclair Spectrums, Commodore 64s, BBCBs. Well, maybe not a BBCB, that was more of a school machine, but maybe Amstrad CPC 464s. And I remember coding music on them. That would be very rudimentary. And I suppose that 8-bit period led to 8-bit music, which now has become a little bit of a thing. You know, it's a bit of a style in itself. But that was a time when I do remember programmatically generating music. I think the first tune that I produced was, or that I tried to replicate on, was some piece of classical music.
Yeah, well, I think, it was by Grieg, actually.
On a CPC 464, but that was a lot of people could produce music that way.
Yeah, certainly. I think along with electronic instruments, you had the controllers that went with it, like the sequencers, and I think that made a big difference because, you know, I guess if you remember from school, somebody who did lessons could play the piano or play the guitar, but you needed some sort of lessons to get the muscle memory, or the muscle techniques to be able to do that. But with electronic instruments, you know, if you had, as a, you know, by the 80s, a computer where you could program it, or you had a sequencer, you could actually make music.
Yeah, you bypassed the whole motor skill part.
Exactly, yeah.
But early sequencers, sorry, I know we're drifting, we're jumping around early, but early sequencers, what springs to mind there?
Well, I suppose, you know, if I start, I can think of a couple of examples to see where I have something here that is a good example of a sequencer. Actually, this is a lovely track, which is a mixture. I think there's a sequencer in the bass, maybe, on this. This is by Tonto. Isn't that a lovely bass sound?
Yeah, what is that? Who's that, though? What's
Tonto's
going on there?
Tonto's expanding headband.
Tonto, sorry.
Yeah. So it's Malcolm Cecil. So Tonto stands for something like the Tambourine Orchestra. So basically, Malcolm Cecil was an interesting character. He put together many, many modules to build a polyphonic synthesizer. So the earliest synthesizers really were monophonic. And they could only play one note at a time. So if you wanted to have polyphonic music, you had to record the tracks, individual tracks, and layer them one on top of each other. So Malcolm Cecil decided to make a polyphonic instrument by connecting many, many modules together and whatever, building the control logic that allowed him to do that. Because it was really until the end of the 70s with the Prophet 5 that you had a reasonably affordable polyphonic synthesizer. Before that, it was very expensive. So Malcolm Cecil is a famous character in that area, and the Tonto's expanding headband. There's only a few LPs, but they're really nice.
And you're saying there's a sequencer involved there. How was that built? How was that? Was that something that was a...
I think they might have been able to build them with... No, I'm not sure. Maybe... I think nowadays they can build them using logic circuits quite easily. But back then... Yeah. Back then, I suppose the sequencer really... It had a clock, so it had to clock through maybe, 16 different notes or 32 notes or whatever. And... it would, you'd set it running at a certain beats per minute, and it would clock through each note that you set on it, and it would output those notes as control voltages, and they would trigger the synthesizer.
Oh wow! Right. So a musician back then interested in this sort of music, in this kind of relatively avant-garde music, would have had some skills, had some making skills, some electronic skills, understanding of electrical principles.
Oh, certainly, yeah. Well, it did require because the connecting all these modules together and getting them to work. Because basically, with a module, you have a front panel with some knobs, some switches, some inputs, and some outputs. And if you connect it together correctly, you can make something very beautiful. But if you connect it together badly, you can make just cacophony, or maybe nothing at all. Maybe you'll get no sound out. So you do need to have a certain understanding about the fundamentals of signals and how signals interact with each other, and how one signal can be used to trigger another, and what impact you may have in modulating one signal using another signal. So it does. So it makes you work at your technical knowledge, but also your musical understanding then as well, to make something that's beautiful.
So that's real, yeah. So some really in-depth skills required there. So what democratized maybe electronic music in terms of musicians to really, with some skills, be able to produce music and be creative?
I think really the microprocessor did that. So microprocessors back at the end of the 60s, the early 70s, were pretty difficult to use and program, and maybe not so powerful. But Dave Smith of the of Sequential Circuits, the builder Prophet 5, he built one of the first microprocessor controlled synthesizer, and that really led to a sea change in that now you could make instruments that were a little bit more like pianos. You could play chords on them. They were sufficiently cheap and light enough that people could carry around. Things didn't get really cheap till they went digital. Yamaha brought out the DX7, which used a completely different synthesis technique. But Dave Smith, really, the principle was set. I can give an example here of another track. This is a disco track where, I suppose, the most famous sequencer track in disco is I Feel Love. By Giorgio Moroder and Donna Summer. But this is another one by Cerrone. Hopefully, there might be some scratches in this.
That's the least of our problems with this Zoom call. Scratches on your vinyl. But anyway.
Just down below.
Right, Joe, that's got a real disco sound for sure. And it's very dancey. Joe, I'm just thinking we might have to get you on again in a few more for a few more of these podcasts, because we still haven't left the 80s.
We haven't, no.
We barely entered the 80s. Are we mid 80s?
Cerrone is the late 70s. I think that's a disc.
No, we did get into the 80s briefly for a minute. No, I sensed 1983.
Yeah. Well, I could have another 80s tune. I wonder if you recognize this. This is kind of interesting. This is, I actually loved this song when it came out. Right. I don't know if you remember this. Einstein, go, go. If you remember that track.
No, Joe, what is that?
That was out in Landscape. That was out in about 1981 or 82. So
there we go.
The name of the LP is From the Tea Rooms of Mars to the Hell Holes of Uranus.
I can't remember that album gracing my shelves.
The Sex Pistols album is.
Well, what are we hearing there? What sort of, how is that music created?
Well,
what sort of?
So you can hear a nice, lovely bass line in it.
Yeah, but that sounds very electronic. It's all electronic, right?
And you have some high-end synth with a kind of flute-type sound in it. And then there's probably some other instruments playing chords in the middle of it like that.
So were they analog synths?
I think so. I think they certainly, the DX7 really only came out after that. So I think it's pre-DX7. That was maybe around the time when you would have had Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark, Human League, who else, bands like that? Those kind of, Depeche Mode, when they were popular in the UK in the very early 80s, in the beginning. Those bands changed then over the coming years.
And so, Joe, that sort of music inspired you were obviously always interested in music, but inspired maybe the engineering side of you too.
Oh, certainly, yeah. Well, I just didn't know for a long time. The funny thing is when I bought records, once in a while, you might see the names of the instruments listed on it. But, in the day pre the internet, you'd have no clue what they meant because you couldn't walk into a shop in Dublin and say, I'd like to see an Oberheim OBX. Do you have one of them? And I'd be like, what? because in Ireland, maybe if you were in New York or some, big, big city, it might be easy to come across these instruments. But there were very few of them in Ireland, for certain. And there's only a few kind of known players that were in the country. I must find some examples later of that. Maybe from a band. There was one good Irish electro band called Auto da Fé, which I was quite liked at the time.
Right. Where were they from?
They were from Dublin, really. So Trevor Knight was in them. He's still around. He's still playing. But I'll have to find now. If you could give me a minute, I'll find the record. But otherwise, I'll play it in our next.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And you hit upon something very interesting there. And again, when it's thinking about the democratization of music creation through electronic means, the internet has been incredibly valuable and it's been an incredible resource for sharing knowledge and providing. I suppose insights into how things are done because I remember there recently several of your makes that I've seen at Dublin Maker over the past few years, they were these almost like a Kickstarter sort of electronics kits that you've been using, almost, you know, the projects that have gone, they've scaled up a little bit beyond this a one-off project, you know, the kits, I guess.
Yeah. And I think, well, the other thing, I suppose, computers have made things easier too. So I guess, you know, if you have a computer, you can program your own synthesis now. So you can make your own synthesizer in software.
You can. And that's interesting. But yeah, I suppose there's something.
And of course, what's fed into that then is now you can run that software in something like a Raspberry Pi.
Well, see, there you go.
Or you can build a controller out of an Arduino.
Yeah, I do enjoy the hands-on, the analog side of it, the circuit-based synthesis. But again, I guess, I don't know, it's the tactile. It's, even though you might argue.
Well, this is it.
Any more tactile. But like, for example, you can get a DX7 as a little virtual plugin for your Ableton or whatever. And there's your DX7. It's just, but it's not quite the same as, you know, seeing the board.
Well, I suppose the DX7 is to blame a little bit for the lack of user interface options when that came out in the 80s, because synthesizers up to the DX7 had quite a lot of knobs, buttons for interacting with. And the DX7, I suppose, in a move to cut down on costs, and because maybe it was quite complicated.
Joe, do you know what I'm thinking for our podcast? I think the DX7 will have... We'll have a kind of a B, C, and A, D, but it'll be probably B, DX7 and A, DX7.
Yeah.
That's going to be our watershed. And we might have another podcast where we discuss it.
Yeah, we could do. All right. Yeah, and I could find a few more examples.
But to go back to the analog synths, just you can't, I mean, there's something very exciting about, you know, tuning your own oscillators and, you know, getting the resonances and, you know, just... experimenting with components to get, you know, to get just that little variation in sound that just, you know, makes something very unique or interesting. That's what I like about those sort of musical projects, you know,
I suppose you learn a lot too about electronics as well, because it's kind of funny, maybe if you do a course in electronics, you learn a bit about oscillators and you learn a bit about filters. But you don't have them applied in that context of making music. They're in some more abstract context of,
stability. Yeah, we're always taught to avoid instability, avoid oscillation, of course. And from a musical perspective, it's the opposite situation. You're trying to find these resonances and these rich harmonics and so on. But
exactly. Yeah.
You know, Joe, you know, now you're sparking off so many thoughts. I must get you on, or maybe you can invite somebody on the show and someday in the future to talk about even guitar pedals. I'm just thinking of some of the guitar pedals you were modding and developing over the past years, but that's another podcast, I guess, right?
Yeah, certainly. I suppose you could do a lot, because guitar pedals have... Well, the market has really changed a lot. I guess when I was, I suppose I'm not young enough to appreciate it, but guitar pedals really, they may have started in the late 1950s and they began to appear maybe a little bit more in the 60s. By the end of the 60s, you know, someone like Jimi Hendrix really brought guitars and effects to the forefront. But it wasn't really till the end of the maybe 70s that they'd become a very strong commercial market there, in the sense you had, you know, the standard pedals were made by Boss, you know, those multicolored pedals you get in the shops, and then you had, you know, the cheaper versions. But then that market was sort of rocked a bit by the digital version.
Oh, absolutely, Joe. I'm going to stop you there, because we're going to have a podcast in the future, because I know many people will be interested in hearing that, including myself. A bit selfish, but anyway. So back to our, let's see.
Yeah, well, let me play a few more examples. And that's
what do you have?
Then from, just from the Discware, a couple of things I like from that. And just play a few things. This we were talking about. Synthesizers and different countries. This is one from Japan. Mm-hmm. very 1980s kind of synth funk by Ohashi from Japan. And you can hear the TR-808 drum machine in there as well.
Oh my goodness. Now we brought up the 808. We could have a whole show on that.
Yeah, well, didn't I? I did a 909 drum machine there from a kit a few years ago. That was
really fun. Oh, I remember that? That's that was a super drum machine, and the wiring looked a nightmare.
Yeah, that was fun.
That's still on YouTube. I think in the Maynooth Makers Club that got quite a number of views. It wasn't a particularly instructional video, if I remember. It was basically you gave us a tour of the board and the. And a demonstration of its sounds, which was amazing. Mm. Wow, wiring.
It was a lot of fun to make, but it took a couple of years because I kind of went out of my way to get as many rare parts as I could. And then because it was such a slow build, you know, it took a good while to get everything right because I wanted it to work.
Well, it did work.
It did.
Tell me it's still working. Tell me it still works.
It is. It was working the last time I tried it anyway. So.
Okay. And so the 909, when was that? That'd be kind of late 80s, right?
Well, that was 80, after the 808. So the 909, I think, is probably about 83, 84.
Oh, all right. I'm at 83. Right. So, okay, that's an interesting.
But that's a hybrid. That's an analog digital system.
On
memory, while the 808 was a pure analog system. So
this is too much. I want to talk about the 808. I want to talk about the 909.
Yeah,
and we don't have time to talk.
Yeah,
about
that's another also. Podcast anyway.
Well, so what have we learned today? I mean, what have our listeners learned today? What have they learned? Maybe the inspiration, I guess, for many musicians in terms of electronics would be soundtracks. Is that where synthesizers first? I suppose.
Yeah, I think so. Well, it brought together. So I guess synthesizers bring together music and electronics in one kind of neat bundle where you can do two things you like to do, kind of making stuff and also playing stuff. So.
Yeah. And then so there's a strong rooting there in sci-fi movies. That's what I'm hearing.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Well, ever since Forbidden Planet in the 50s, where, you know, the Barons, they built their own instruments to create the sci-fi sounds in that movie.
They did? Well, how come we didn't talk about them?
Because I don't have it in vinyl LP. I have it on CD.
Oh, well, it's on CD. Well, forget about it.
I don't have it convenient here. But maybe we could do another podcast. We could do another podcast on sci-fi.
Well, in the 50s. All right. No, Joe, we need to bring this up. We need to get into this century at some point. Look. But we'll do, maybe we'll have you on again, or maybe you can even invite in maybe a guest of your choice. Talk about maybe some of the synthesizers and the synthesis technologies that people could get involved with that would maybe replicate some of those sounds of the 70s and 80s, you know? And particularly, let's bring in the 808, because we can focus, maybe if we can anchor on the 808 and build out from there and then head towards the 909.
Yeah.
In another episode, we can talk about maybe digital synthesis.
Yeah, well, there's a few different kit options now out there too. If somebody did want to do a build themselves, there's a few options there now.
Which, okay, there'll be some people listen to this, maybe one or two people, who will say, right, this is interesting. I want to get hands-on with something right now. I know what a Raspberry Pi is. I know what an Arduino is. What could I do? Could you make something simple to get people introduced that's not, you know, that's something that's electronic component based.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I think the simplest thing is either to build kind of a guitar pedal. Some guitar pedals, like a distortion pedal, are relatively straightforward. And they'll test your making skills in terms of both, you know, soldering onto boards, soldering off board parts like potentiometers and, you know, input and output jacks, and trying to put something into a box. So you get the whole off through that.
And is there some simpler, something they can do on an Arduino? I'm just thinking there's many people out there.
There are some things you can do, but you can get some shield, like there was one speech synthesis shield I had for the Arduino before that I think also has some sound synthesis built in. The Arduino can create a pulse width modulation waves, so you can drive that as a type of synthesizer.
Mm-hmm. Oh, hang on. I remember you built a great sequencer on your Arduino.
We did. Yeah, that was, but I had bought the, no, I have to say, I got the board, the extra board from someone from that. That's broken now, actually. The last time I used it, it wouldn't work.
Oh, it was pretty cool, though. All right. I mean, it was really fundamental. I really liked it.
But there's also now, I think, with the Raspberry Pi, you can get some very good high-quality audio boards. So I think that the audio built into the Raspberry Pi is not so good. But mm-hmm. if you get one of these high-quality boards, you can get a far better standard of audio coming out of it. That'll be an incentive then to do some sort of synthesis on it then, too.
Okay, and is there any particular online resources for that that you recommend?
I can find some resources. I'll have to, maybe we could post them afterwards.
Yeah, we can.
Yeah,
we
had someone had asked me, there's some good kits too if you want to build modules. There's a couple of companies in the UK that sell module kits from, you know, there's something cheap to something quite expensive. But of course, I'm starting with something simple.
Yeah, we are going to start simple, but then we're going to have another podcast sometime in the future, it'll be this year, next year, dedicated. And those people are out there, some might be listening, the Eurorack heads. Mm. We'll have to have something on that.
Mm.
Is that something you've ever been involved in?
Well, not for a long while, but I certainly was interested in it for a good while.
All right. Well, I think I might talk to some people and get them on the show. They can maybe educate us all about what they're doing and that. Anyway, there's no end to music inspired making. It drives a lot of interest in a lot of people. Not everybody, of course.
Yeah.
But it's certainly a theme that maybe we might talk about in the future.
Yeah.
So, well, Joe, we're going to have to kind of to wrap this up.
Okay. Well, I play one more track then to finish up.
Yeah, to take us out, right?
I'll pick an old inspiration, but this is something I only got to listen to maybe later. But this is Walter Carlos, Switch and Bach too, and that really set a lot of things off. This was this really got a lot of the world interested in synthesizers.
What is it? Did you say Johann? Is this Bach set to electronica?
Yeah.
What? Oh, right. That's what that is. What you said, right?
I just play this, and hopefully this will be okay now. Nice way to end a great podcast.
Joe. Okay, Joe, listen, thank you so much for coming on the show. I look forward to listening back in this podcast and maybe catch up with some of those fairly some references there that I probably wouldn't have known about before the show. So I definitely learned a lot, and look forward to talking to you again.
All right, Tomas, thanks very much. Hopefully.
All right. Cheers, Joe.
And that, folks, is a wrap of our final episode for this series of the Doublemaker podcast. Thanks to our guests, hosts, and of course, all of you who have been listening to our podcast. And if you haven't checked out the rest of the episodes, head over to doublemaker.buzzsprout.com. You can also find us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. So take care, stay safe, and this is Vicky signing off from the Doublemaker podcast.